I just got up and went to take a step on my left foot and just collapsed to the floor, like a big, big thud to the floor. I couldn't feel anything on my left side. I was like, I didn't know, I had no idea what was going on or what even happened. My wife hopped up and was like, what's going on? And she was going to call the ambulance, but I told her to hold it, man, let me see if I can move any of my body on my left side. You know, I just started meditating on God in the name of Jesus. And then my wife was like, let me call the ambulance. And I was like, no, hold up. The spirit spoke to me and said, peace, be still. And also instructed me to go to the VA.
Here is my interview with Alex Mobley. He has had an amazing life and has witnessed and experienced many miracles. His mother was shot in the head and was brought back from the dead when he was 11. She was bedridden for 10 years, and Alex's father was faithful and took care of her. Alex survived growing up in Jamaica, Queens in the 80s crack era. He was in the army for 3 years and unknowingly suffered with lupus the whole time. He almost died and had to spend a year in the hospital. He was in a rap group and was a concert promoter, had bipolar disorder, and had to defend his family against an extortionist and spent a year in prison. He is recovering from a stroke which paralyzed the left side of his body. He can now walk and has faith that he will have a full recovery. He sees all of these adversities as a blessing which God has used to mold him into the person he is today. This interview is just a small introduction to Alex's story. Welcome to the Miracle Hotline podcast. I'm Dino Pandolfo. Everyone has experienced a miracle at some point in their life. Maybe you have prayed for a miracle, or maybe you are in desperate need of help. When a miracle happens, it is overwhelming, amazing, and you are so grateful for the gift God has given you. This podcast gives you the opportunity to share your miracle story so that others may believe and have hope, and it will encourage them to keep praying in difficult times. This show examines miracles. It includes first-person accounts, interviews, and investigations of the most credible and amazing miracle stories. You can tell us about your miracle by leaving a message at 412-446-0330 or visiting miraclehotline.com. We may play your message or interview you on the podcast. Subscribe to the Miracle Hotline podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any podcast app to automatically download the newest episodes. Thank you so much, Alex, for welcoming me into your home and sharing your miracle experience.
No problem.
Alex Mobley is the founder of The Body of Believers Unified and is writing a book called The Theory of Balance. He is a U.S. Army veteran and was member of the rap group Unorthodox Tactics. So, Alex, you have a miracle story or many miracles.
Yes.
We spoke briefly about them, but I don't know the whole story at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you could tell me your story, and then I'll just jump in when I have questions or whatever. So go ahead and start from wherever.
Sure. The miracle I wanted to share today is of me having a stroke. I just had a stroke in August 2020. Well, August that just passed. And what happened, I was just like any other day, I was going to get up to go to the bathroom early in the morning, and I fell flat to the ground. You know, I just got up and went to take a step on my left foot and just collapsed to the floor, like a big, big thud to the floor. I couldn't feel anything on my left side. I was like, I didn't know, I had no idea what was going on or what even happened. My wife hopped up and was like, what's going on? And she was going to call the ambulance, but I told her to hold it, man, let me see if I can move any of my body on my left side.
Yeah.
And I couldn't. So I was just I was just like shocked that I couldn't move at all, anything on my left side. And I was like, you know, I just started meditating on God in the name of Jesus. And then my wife was like, let me call an ambulance. And I was like, no, hold up, because something telling me I need to go to the VA.
Yeah.
Not, if she would have called the ambulance, it would have took me to the nearest hospital around North Broadout.
Right, right.
And the spirit spoke to me and said, peace, be still. Like, peace, be still. And also instructed me to go to the VA. Now, later on, in hindsight, I could see why. But at the time, I didn't know. I was just being obedient. So I just stood there and laid there for about an hour or two. My wife helped me get back on the bed, and I just sat there. I said, let me give it a couple of hours to see if anything come back. And nothing did, so I was like, all right.
So did you know it was a stroke at the time?
No, I had no idea.
So you just try to get out of bed like you normally do. Mm-hmm. And your health yes. before this was
fine. I mean, I have other health issues like lupus.
Yeah.
Since I was 20 years old, but I have many health issues other than that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I had no idea about this stroke or why it happened or anything like that. Yes.
Yeah. So you tried to step and you just fell.
Yes, on my left foot. I took one step with my left foot and that was it. It just fell yeah. right to the floor as soon as I got out of the bed.
Oh gosh. You know,
as soon as I got out of the bed. And my wife was kind of panicking a little bit, of course.
Yeah, then, really, you
yeah,
would.
Naturally. But I told her, just peace be still. And I told her the spirit spoke to me and told me to stay and not go to the hospital unless it's to the VA hospital. And so I right. waited like 3 days till I was strong enough to actually get outside. Because what I had to do, I had to get the office
chair. So what did you think it was? I mean, you can't
I had no
walk.
Idea. Well, my wife looked it up on yeah. The internet. She Googled it and searched on WebMD.
Yeah.
And she said, you probably had a stroke. All the symptoms that you having is what it says a stroke is.
Yeah.
So my wife told me it was a stroke. And I was like, okay, it's a stroke. You know, okay. you know.
But was she, I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, was your wife like flipping out or what?
A little bit she was, but she trusted me. She trusted my, what I told her and what the spirit told me. She trusted it. Because, you know. Later on, getting into this, I'll give you the backstory, but I've been in hospitals all my life. I've been dealing with situations like this many times.
Right.
So okay. this is not new to me, or a stroke is new,
right.
but being and having a medical emergency is not new. It's not new to me. So I just decided to listen to the spirit, what the spirit told me, and trust what I was hearing, and I did that. Even if I didn't understand it, I learned over time that you understanding the voice of God or the spirit, Holy Spirit speaking to you, your understanding it is not a requirement. Your being obedient is.
So you had this, and so you decided not to go to the hospital, and
mm-hmm.
because you thought God told you not
the
to
Holy
go to
Spirit.
The Holy Spirit.
Yeah, it's different. It's, the Holy Spirit is the spirit of God inside of us. You know, it's not God directly, but it's his spirit to aid us.
Okay.
You know, that travels with, like, people always say the Holy Ghost, the Holy Spirit. And you could just look at it mentally, physically, emotionally, or spiritually. We experience this world in the spiritual part. Part of us is spiritual. When a human passes away, the energy doesn't die. It just transforms and goes
right.
to another level. So,
so you had the stroke. You tried to walk. You get back into bed.
Mm-hmm.
After the mm-hmm. shock wears off.
Yes. My wife feeds me, take care of me.
But immediately you knew, do not call 911.
Do not call an ambulance because it was going to take me to another hospital other than the VA. For some reason, the spirit was directing me straight to that VA, go to the VA.
Yeah.
You know, so I just listened. And basically what I was waiting for was me to get strong enough to make it to my curb down.
Yeah.
To make it past these steps and those steps. So on the third day, that's when I attempted to go to the curb to catch an Uber to the VA. So
I mean, were you trying to like avoid a hospital, an ambulance ride?
Not at all.
Because
at all.
I know an ambulance ride is $1,000.
Yes, it is expensive.
You know?
No, but that wasn't my worry.
That wasn't the issue.
Uh-huh. Being a veteran, I knew that even if I took an ambulance to another hospital, the VA would have covered the bill.
Yeah, okay.
Once I got to the VA at some point in the future, they would have covered the
bill.
Okay,
so that wasn't a concern is that... Because mm-hmm. I'm like that. I'm like, if I go to the doctor, they're going to charge me all this money and they're going to do nothing or whatever. You know, I just... Mm-hmm. I don't go to the doctor unless...
I'm
dying, you know, or whatever.
which this was serious. I couldn't move my left side, so I fell to the floor. That's pretty serious.
That
That's
is.
Something you would call an ambulance for.
Right.
But because they would have took me to a different hospital, I waited to go to the VA.
So you heard, you had the Holy Spirit tell you, just wait, and then
peace be still, go to the VA hospital.
And you heard that?
Yes.
And how did you know it was the Holy Spirit?
Well, one of my main gifts is... it's spiritual gifts. That's just something God gave me from birth, but I'm very in tune with spirit things of a spiritual nature. So, just like even seeing things, but people see with their physical eyes, I can see things of a spiritual realm.
Yeah,
just like that. The same way you see physically, I can see things.
And that
spiritually,
these,
not all
what
the
you're
time,
saying
but
is a miracle
times.
In itself. Is ability to see and hear God and the Holy Spirit and spiritual things. I mean, that's a miracle in itself because most people like me cannot do that.
Yes, and that's good you brought that up. I'm glad you did bring that up because that's a common thing I run into. This looking at every human being individually, we all have many gifts and talents that God gives each certain person. So yeah. We all don't have the same talents.
Yeah.
So some people who might not have the spiritual sight like I have or spiritual gifts, but each gift has numerous ways of exhibiting itself or expressing itself. Like right. My wife, she takes pictures and she could catch spirits on camera. She has a phone full of pictures, but she's not able to see it like I am.
Yeah.
So she doesn't see it, but she's able to catch it.
So she can take a picture.
It's a feeling she has to take a picture.
And when the image appears,
it's a spirit.
You can see
a spirit
in the picture, like a white shadow or something.
Yes, just like that.
Well, I'm going to have to interview her.
My wife has a picture of me. We went to visit her grandfather and grandmother. She has a picture with me with her grandfather where it's an angel literally in the background. And you can see the shape of the wings.
She's next.
Yeah, you can see the next. Yes, you can see the shape of the wings and everything.
Wow. So. Well, that's I definitely want to hear about that.
Yes.
Okay, so back to your story.
Yes.
After all my dumb questions.
No, no problem. I love it.
3 days later. Keep continuing.
3 days later.
I won't interrupt you.
3 days later, me and my wife, I told my wife, I said, okay, I think I'm strong enough to try to get to the hospital with your help. So the chair that you in is a chair that we use. We wheeled that chair to the bedroom with the wheels, office chair. And I sat in the chair and I scooted with my legs. My wife pushed me to the front door. And I got out of the chair, sat on the floor, and I scooted down the steps with my wife. My wife held my left side and I scooted on my right side that I had power on.
Right.
And so when I got to the bottom, I stood up with my right leg, got in that chair again. My wife carried the chair down and rolled me down the walkway to the front steps.
Yeah.
And we repeated the same process. And then we called the Uber.
But right there. Couldn't you just get an ambulance to take you to the, say, I want to go to the VA?
No, by law, they got to take me to the closest hospital.
Oh, so that's the only way you could get to
the VA,
where you wanted to be.
Yes, the VA hospital.
I got you.
Yes.
All right.
And so I went to the VA hospital, went in. And they asked me all these questions about what happened and stuff. I told them, and they said, you had a stroke, you know.
Yeah.
And it was like, how soon you had the stroke? And they was like, do you just have it now? I was like, no, about 3 days ago. It was like, 3 days? It was like, 3 days ago. They were like, my God, man, you supposed to come here.
Because you could have died too, right?
Yes. Yeah, they say I could have, but I knew I wasn't. You know, I trusted God that much.
You trusted God you were not going to die.
Yes, definitely. I had just had that faith from not, and this is why I chose this miracle to share, because the faith I have during this miracle, it wasn't the faith I had when I was 20 or 25, but because of what I've been through in my past, enabled me to handle this situation in that I had currently right now. And I'm still in the midst of this storm and this trial and tribulations right now.
Yeah.
I'm still healing from it. So we went to the hospital. They said I had a stroke. They ran all kind of tests on me at the VA immediately. And they saw I was okay. I was fine. But I was completely flaccid. And what people don't know, a complete flaccid means you just can't move nothing. I couldn't move my pinky, thumb. I was so the stroke actually even paralyzed part of my bowel system. So I couldn't go to the bathroom. I couldn't even push
to go to the bathroom. So it was your whole half of your body.
Everything. Yeah, I really couldn't speak well.
So your left,
couldn't talk.
Your left side.
I couldn't swallow on my left
side.
Your
face. Your
everything.
Your arm.
Everything.
Your leg.
From the head
even
down.
Even your
stomach, leg.
Your
everything.
Internal organs.
Yes, fingers. Nothing. I couldn't move. Nothing.
Okay.
And when I went to the hospital, they ran the test and they sent me to Aspinwall, and that's where I had a doctor who gave me the diagnosis of what had happened. So Aspinwall is like long term, but that's where all the PT, OT, all the physical therapy stuff is. It's more of a long term hospital for older patients, so they have more.
And when did this happen?
August. August.
This
I don't remember.
August?
I remember the exact date, but it was in August.
But
2020.
It's now what is it? May.
Yes.
So that was
10 months ago.
About 10 months ago.
Exactly. exactly 10 months ago. And what I learned that happened, I had my stroke on my brainstem. And for those who might not know or do know, the brainstem controls all your body functions. I mean, everything is controlled on your brainstem. And that's where I had my stroke. And I didn't have a small stroke. I had a pretty big stroke.
Okay.
You know, so the doctor came in and her diagnosis was like, I'm going to tell you the truth. I don't want to give you no false hope. But you had your stroke in the worst possible place you could have it. It's on your brainstem. So she was like, think of 376 at rush hour.
Right.
all them cars are your body functions.
Yeah.
So that's how, that's the, you know, the number of place that, that's like how much body function is controlled in that area that you had the stroke. And she was like, if you come back, I might give you like 5% chance to come back 100%. It's very rare. It's very, it's unlikely that you're going to, she wasn't trying to give me a downer. She was just telling me the blunt truth.
Yeah.
You know, she was like, it's very rare that anybody like recovers a large percentage of their mobility from this kind of stroke because of where you had it. You know, the Pacific spot. But the whole time she was talking, I was like, I'm listening. I'm like, I already know God's going to help me. I already know it.
So that's,
in my heart, in my soul.
So that's the part I'm starting to understand about your reaction to your stroke. When it happened, you were shocked, but you were not panicking. You were not afraid.
No, I wasn't panicking, no. And that's, if that was the only miracle I witnessed or thing that I went through in my life, I would have been.
So you have enough faith when this happened.
Yes.
That you weren't afraid.
No, not at all. It's not because of where I was at the moment. It's because I've been through so much adversity, so many trials, and God has done so much for me already in my life. I already seen so many miracles. So I knew there's nothing impossible.
So you had trust in God. You weren't flipping out like
I
would. I'd oh my gosh, it's the end of the world.
Yes.
You know,
no,
I'm dying.
No, I wasn't.
You know, whatever. You were like, okay.
Yes.
And God spoke to you
already,
or the Holy Spirit.
Yes, yes.
And he said, you know, just keep calm. Everything's going to be okay.
Yes.
And you trust
completely.
Him.
Yes, I trusted him completely. And that was so shocking to everybody.
And that's why you're waiting for the ambulance. That's why all this. So I understand now. Okay. I got you.
And everybody in the hospital was really shocked at my response to it. They didn't understand it. Like, why is this guy so calm? Why is he not panicking? Like, why is he not scared? Why is he, you know...
It is unusual. That's why I can't even understand it. It took me so long to understand what's going on because it is so very unusual.
Yes.
Now I understand. Okay.
Yes.
And it's so not, you got the diagnosis and it's really... bad.
Grave.
You're still not worried.
It's grave. They're telling me like I probably won't be able to walk again. I probably won't be able to use my arms again, my leg. Like they're telling me like they're trying to prepare me for what they think is going to be the diagnosis or the conclusion of what's going to happen to me.
Right.
You know, they're trying to prepare me for that. Like, you could get some mobility back. Or, you know, we might have to wear braces on your whole arm, your leg, all this kind of stuff. But that's what I started out with.
Yeah.
You know, but they said,
But you could talk normally? Because I know sometimes
I could talk, but it wasn't, it was different. Like my voice was
like
really different.
Because of your face.
It was slurring and stuff. Yes.
But some people just lose the ability to speak.
To speak
completely. That's like a different part of the brain, I guess.
Yes, it is. Yes. Okay. It affected my speech, but not greatly.
Yeah.
But I couldn't swallow without choking and nothing like that.
So it was just the physical part of your body, which was making your speech not as good.
Yes, okay. Yes. Mm-hmm. And they ran a test to make sure that I wasn't going to have another stroke or wasn't a possibility of me having another stroke.
Right.
And then they sent me from Oakland, VA, to Asinwar.
Okay.
I already said that already. So this is where I wound up, and they had me going to COVID ward because, you know, COVID was like in the height of the COVID when I went into the hospital. So my wife was a little bit panicky, but she was just trusting in God, you know, and was calm and remained strong for me.
Yeah.
So they took me to the physical part of, I think it was 1A, 1B, the COVID ward. And like as soon as I got there, and this is the reason why God instructed me to go to the VA, because this is an amazing part of the story. Almost every single person that was involved in my care to this very day was either a believer or a person of love. One or the other. Like 95% of everybody I dealt with from that point until still today were people of God. Every care, every doctor, every physician, every therapist was people of faith. You know, so now at that time, I started to understand why God told me to go there. Because of what happened. Like most people, when they face adversity, they look at it as a bad or a negative thing. By me being through so much adversity in my life, you know, I don't look at adversity as a negative thing. I look at it as that's how God shapes people. The trials and tribulations of what we go through is how God shapes us into who we become and who we are, and to serve him better for what he purpose he has going for us moving forward in life. For example, to explain why I have this mindset, I have to go back a little bit. So I'll go back to when I was 11. This is the first miracle I've seen, and this is my mother. My mother was shot in the hand and the face by a man who tried to abduct her and kidnap her, put her into a van. So she fought the guy off. The guy shot her through the hand, then shot her in the face, and a bullet bounced around and ripped up her face. So they came and got me out of school. And when I came home, I saw the blood, the chalk line where my mother was laying, with blood splattered all over
it. Oh, my gosh.
And because I had to go home, meet my parents, my family, and took me to the hospital.
Yeah.
So when I get to the hospital, my mother's face is the size of a volleyball. A doctor comes to me, and he says, let me talk to you, son. They was like, we did all we can. And he had, like, tears coming down his face. He wasn't crying or weeping, but he had, like, tears coming down his face because he was like, we did all we could for your mother. Your mother's not going to make it.
Oh, my gosh.
So you have a couple of minutes. You and your sister can go in there and talk to your mother.
So you're 11 years old.
11 years old.
You come home from school.
Yeah, they came and got me out of school.
They got you out of school.
My family came and got me, yeah.
And you see blood and the chalk line where your mother was.
But that attack happened. And you yeah, at 11 years old, I can't even explain the shock and stuff of knowing until I even got to the hospital. Then when I got to the hospital, I actually seen my mother, and she had blood. Like, it was like her face was so swollen and big. It was like the size of a volleyball, and it was all kind of pus and blood, you know, and I didn't know if she could hear me or not, but my mother raised me in the church. So she said, whenever you in trouble, call on the name of Jesus. And that's what I did. I went in there and called on the name of Jesus, held her hand, told her I loved her and everything. Yeah. And I left out. And when I left out, I didn't know this was the third hospital they life flighted my mother to.
Oh, okay.
You know, so this ain't the first, it was the third hospital. They was trying to save her life. And what happened, a big accident happened on the highway with a bus or something. And they had to do triage on my mother. They was like, she's unsavable.
Yeah.
So they put my mother in the morgue.
Oh.
My mother was in the morgue. They put my mother in the morgue. Technically, she died. I seen when they wheeled her out of her room, but I didn't know where he was going or what happened. Yeah. And then the next thing I know, I seen a big argument out in the hallway. And one of my cousins who was in the army, who was a battlefield nurse or something like that, said, let me see my cousin. You know, she demanded to see my mother. And they was not going to let her, but the whole family got together. And it was like, okay, let her down to see her cousin. So when she went down into the morgue, my mother technically was dead. She died. This is about 10 minutes. So my aunt had a bag, two bag or whatever. This is what I heard after. I didn't know nothing was happening at the time. But my aunt opened my mother's mouth and looked in her airways. My aunt pulled out all these blood clots out of my mother's nose and out of my mother's mouth. And my mother gasped for air. She came back
to
life.
So your cousin, who was her niece.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
She was a nurse.
A nurse, a medic in the military.
A medic in the
military. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And she just decided to do this.
Yeah, and she brought her bag that she used, you know, from the army when she was in the field. She brought her bag.
Because your mother was in the morgue.
In the morgue. She technically was dead. She wasn't alive. She died in that room.
She was dead. She died in the morgue. Mm-hmm. And your cousin wants to see her.
Yes.
Opens her mouth, pulls
her nose and everything. Yes.
Blood clots, and your mother comes back to life.
She grasped, she took a big thing of air, swallow of air, and came back. So this is like almost 20 minutes.
Wow.
And my mother's testimony is on the YouTube channel for the Body of Believers Unified. Yeah. That long interview I'm talking about my book. My mother actually phones in and actually talks about what happened in that 20 minutes.
So your mom's still alive now.
My mother's alive. She was bedridden for 10 years and had 47 surgeries.
After this being shot?
After being shot.
In the head.
Yeah, she was bedridden for 10 years. And that not only the miracle is part of the story, what happened when she was dead, she was rising up to heaven. And she spoke to God and said, please, my family needs me. My husband needs me. I have two young children. And she saw a vision of all the people in the church, our home church, Jamaica, Queens, were praying for her. But later on, she realized that was real time, that people came to the church and was praying for my mother's survival.
And she could see them praying.
She could see the people praying.
Because, and she was like somewhere else. Dead. On the, in the,
she was dead on going the other up side to float. She was floating.
Yeah.
And she says she's just was pleading for God to spare her life, to please let her be with her two young kids and her husband.
Wow.
You know, and that wasn't just that only miracle. Another miracle is that my father actually was 31 years old when this happened. He was young.
Yeah.
So he actually stayed, and I got to see the definition of love lived out between a man and a wife. My father stayed with my mother every day, washed her, trained us as kids to feed her, change her colostomy bags, anything medical. Yeah. He did it every day while going to work at 4 o'clock in the morning, every single day working construction.
Wow. So your mother 10 years. Was bedridden
for 10 years. So she,
from
she,
when you were 11.
Yes.
And you guys took care of her, and your father stayed with her. Yes. And was faithful. Mm-hmm.
And that bullet is still in her brain today. So if you see my mother and talk to her, you would never know she was shot.
But so then she got better after 10 years.
She got better, yes. She was fully functional and everything. So
that
was the first miracle I seen in my life.
And you were living that. With my own eyes. You know, that was like part of your whole upbringing is having a miraculous mother and
a father too, because that it affected our whole family. So my dad, any other man, you know, I mean, I know plenty of guys in that situation that would have left.
Yeah,
my mother couldn't perform no wifely activities or be intimate with my dad really. So you know, you tell me what man who would have waited 10 years for somebody.
Yeah, that is
young,
amazing.
31 I mean, years is, old. Yeah,
not amazing, age. But it's really a great thing that he did.
Testament of love. Testament of love. Very powerful. So that was the first miracle I seen. And this is why my mindset, you know, the forward back to the stroke, this is why my mindset is built like that. Another one is when I was 17, you know, through growing up in New York in the crack era, I seen a lot of violence. With my mother, I seen my best friend Gary. I haven't seen that. I wasn't there when it happened, but he shot himself and blew out his brains through a 38 through his mouth. And now that was one of my closest friends. I got pictures with him when I graduated elementary school and everything. Right. What happened? His mother's boyfriend put crack in her weed and pimped her out. Yeah. So whenever I'm at Gary's house playing Atari, he didn't close the door or nothing. He was just running out, tricking his mother out. And, like, Gary would be crying. Oh, like, tears would be coming down his eye. I'm sitting right next to him, my best friend. And it got worse and worse. His mom wasn't even feeding him. So my mother took him in and tried to feed him, you know, give him bag lunches and stuff, much as she could. But one day, one of the tricks that she was running, performing whatever, the guy left his gun in the living room table. And Gary took it and killed himself, shot himself at 14. So this is what I'm experiencing, not only living in the crack era, the height of the crack era in New York City, you know, which is mostly these common inner city neighborhoods had the same issues and problems. But from my sixth floor going down outside to go to school, I might see a lady performing oral sex on somebody for crack. I might see somebody shooting up dope, up crack, like smoking crack every day on the way down to the stairwell. I had great parents, but that environment was horrible.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of kids.
And this is in Jamaica, Queens.
Jamaica, Queens,
in
New York. Yes.
In the 80s or?
Yes. In the 80s, yes. Okay. Exactly. Yeah, in the 80s. And so.
So your friend Gary, when you were 14?
14 years old. 14 years old.
Were you there when this happened?
No, I wasn't there, but I was there what was happening to his mother. I was always there. And, you know, we could see her, you know, he could see guys going in the room in and out. And the guy didn't care. He was laughing. You know, he was basically like a demon in human form, basically, you know, and we could see all this happening every time, you know. But even when I left, when I went back home, he lived there. I could leave. He couldn't. You know, my mom tried to call CYS and all that. Nobody did nothing. They didn't come. They didn't do nothing. So fast forward to my senior year in high school, I was playing football. I was all state in football. I was unbeaten in wrestling. I had the record for throwing shot put and throwing. So I had multiple scholarships. Yeah. But my last year, halfway through, my cousin Thomas got killed. He was trying to get out of a game, and they shot him in the back of the head with a double barrel shotgun and killed him. And that was it. That was like the straw that broke the camel's back. I dropped out of school. I basically lost my mind for a time period. I just couldn't take it no more. So I just joined the military. You know, at 17, my mom and dad had to sign me in. I joined the military. So I joined the military in hopes of getting away from all this violence, all this hurt, all this pain. And when I go into basic training, we running. I'm doing great, losing weight. I was already an athlete, so it's just a different kind of physical activity. So what happened, I caught pneumonia. And when I caught pneumonia, and basically it was like halfway through, and it was me and 8 soldiers. We went running. This is what soldiers do. No big thing. We run. So it rained, and it got way colder than it was. And 8 of us in my platoon caught pneumonia. But they healed. I was the only one who never healed after that. So I started getting fluid in my lungs. So they had to stab me through the lung, into my through the chest to my lung. And they pulled out all this infection, like slime looked like, and goo and stuff. And this is like a miracle even in the midst of this storm, because a drill sergeant named Joe Sergeant Mangini, they was going to recycle me. And this would have had great implications on my life, because if I would have got recycled, I would have never been able to get benefits for what they didn't know at the time, me having lupus.
What does recycle mean?
Recycle means they'll send you back all the way from the beginning in basic training. So like I was like 3/4 ways through basic training when
So you just start at the very beginning.
Yeah, you would start all over from the very beginning. Okay. You know, and I probably wouldn't have made it. But the thing is, a drill sergeant of great love. This is what I mean about living out the definition of love. Joe Sergeant Mangini took me to the side and he said, "Alex, you was doing a great job. This is a bad break. I'm sorry this happened. But I tell you what, they're gonna recycle you. Cause the last PT test already took place." But he was like, "I'ma give you the PT test. If you're willing to take it, it's gonna hurt like hell because of the surgery you had with your lung." He said, "But if you're willing to take it, I will run every mile with you. I'll run every step. I'll do every push up, every sit up right with you." And he did. And that's the only way I made it out of basic. Yeah. Now, 3 years later, let's fast forward to 3 years later. I'm so sick because I had the lupus, the pneumonia lowered my immune system enough for lupus to become active in me.
Okay.
And once it become active, that's it. Now, think of a forest fire burning for 3 years and nobody puts no water on it. I was so sick. I was close on the brink of death. So they sent me to Walter Reed from Korea. And I was so sick, they had to hospitalize me for an entire year. Nobody didn't know what was going on that I had it, but I couldn't open my hand. I couldn't sleep on my back.
So you got pneumonia in your basic training.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You passed through basic training with the help of this...
drill sergeant, yes. Drill sergeant Mangini, yes.
So then you were serving for 3 years.
3 years, yes. And I was sick the whole time.
You were in Korea then?
No, but I went to Korea after my AIT. I went to Fort Jackson, Fort Lee, and then I was in Korea for almost a year. And the thing was, the whole time I was sick.
Yeah,
not definitely sick at that time, but I was very ill. And they were punished because of my physical looking at me. I was cut up, and I can show you a picture of me during that time, but I was cut up, muscular. They thought I was faking, trying to get out the military. Yeah. But the truth is, physically, I had systemic lupus. So that's the kind that goes through your blood and attack organs.
Yeah.
So they couldn't see the sickness, but they just didn't believe me. So I would get punished. I got in fights all that 3 years because they would punish the soldiers for what I couldn't do.
Yeah.
So, you can't do push-ups. You don't want to run. Everybody drop, give me 50. Everybody run this. Alex, you sit there and watch. But everybody else had to run. Geez. So I got blanket parties. I got into numerous fights. I got Article 15s, like disciplinary action, where they would take my whole check for me being sick. Literally, they was punishing me for being sick, but they just didn't know.
They didn't know. Didn't know either. But
no, I didn't know what was going on.
So after
either.
That pneumonia that brought out the lupus, and you had lupus all this whole entire time.
It was progressing rapidly.
And it wasn't as bad at first.
No, but it progressed.
But then it got worse. And did you feel? I mean, you said you couldn't do some of the things.
Severely fatigued. I couldn't even move some days. Like for 3 days at a time, I had to just sit there and stay still. I couldn't even have the energy to get up and move. When I was going outside in the sun, it was affecting me. You know, my hands sometimes, I couldn't even open my hand or close my hand. That's how bad the arthritis was.
Yeah.
Like arthritis symptoms.
And you didn't know it was wrong. And you just tried, you just kept pushing through as good as you could.
As much as I could, yes. Yeah. And so If I lost my mind, didn't lose my mind before, I surely lost my mind then.
Yeah.
Because I was basically being tortured the whole time I was there. Yeah. You know, imagine you being on a base. Everybody got to suffer for what you can't do. Now everybody hates you. I had no friend. I had one friend, right. Lorenzo Jones.
Right.
That was it. So I had no friends. People was cursing me.
And you look fine. So people think you're faking it or you're lazy.
I didn't want to be there.
Whatever. Whatever, I don't know.
Yeah, and that was totally opposite the case, you know. Yeah. I went to the military to get away from all this hurt and pain, and now I'm right back in it again.
Yeah.
And now I can't get out. You know, at a certain point, I started growing my braids, my hair. I didn't shave enough. I was trying to get them to put me out.
Yeah.
When I was in Korea, they still wouldn't put me out.
Yeah.
But thank God a doctor saw something abnormal in my blood, my white blood cells and my red blood cells. He didn't know what it was, but he sent me to Walter Reed. Okay. As soon as I got to Walter Reed, they diagnosed me within a week.
Okay.
With lupus. That's one of the best hospitals in the military, you know. So, but I was so sick, they had to pump me full of steroids intravenously every day for that whole entire year. And during that year, they called my parents 3 times in New York to come visit me because they thought I was going to die.
Oh,
three times my mom and dad came up there.
Yeah.
So when they released me from Walter Reed and I'm stabilized, I go through a medical board to get a medical discharge. But when they stabilized me, they gave me the diagnosis that I only have 5 to 7 years to live.
Wow.
Because the lupus damaged. To this day, every organ in my body is damaged. Everything.
Yeah.
Literally. So they gave me five.
There's no cure for lupus. It's kind of like a cancer. I don't. What is lupus?
It's a blood disorder. It's like sickle cell anemia.
Yeah.
But it's something like that. It's a blood disorder. It's genetic. You know, it runs in families. Mostly women come activated with it. Yeah. It's very rare a man comes active with it. But because of the pneumonia, weakened my immune system. That's what woke it up.
Yeah.
So if I didn't went to the military, probably would remain dormant for the rest of my life. But, you know, but unless I would have caught pneumonia at another time, then that probably could have woke it up.
Yeah.
But, so it's like a hereditary disease and it attacks your whole body. It attacks different. Some people attack their heart, lungs, whatever. But with me, it attacked mostly all my major organs.
So you still have lupus now?
To this day, yes. It just, especially when I came active with lupus, was what, 92, 93? They didn't have nowhere near the medicine they have. Like, lupus was barely a mysterious disease back then. They didn't even know how to treat it except steroids. And the steroids they gave me damaged my pancreas, damaged other parts of my body.
Yeah.
Because the medicine was, technology was so old back then, they just gave the best they did. But it's not advanced as it is today. You know, so think about you're 20 years old, coming from my background, seeing all the violence and dealing with all the drama I'm dealing with, without talking or without getting no therapy from nobody, mind you. Now I'm told I got 5 to 7 years to live.
Yeah.
You know, but today I'm 46 years old. I was 20 then.
Yeah.
So miracles like this that I've seen, you know, that I lived through is why I had that mindset when I had my stroke.
Yeah.
And this is the only thing I dealt with. Because of all this that happened, I struggled with mental illness, bipolar.
Yeah.
I didn't get diagnosed with that till 2009, but, you know, God brought me through that. And, you know, when I went through that 5 or 7 years, I didn't care. I was running the streets. I didn't care about, because I thought I was going to die. I believed everything the doctor told me. So I didn't really care about life at all. I was severely angry at God. I was like, why am I being punished to go through all this? I didn't do nothing.
Yeah.
So why am I going through all this torture and all this pain? But I didn't understand. I had a wisdom.
So after
knowledge.
You got the medical discharge, you went back to New York?
No. I stayed in D.C. I met my first wife, and I married her. And that's when I was, 19? 19 years old, I got married. And I just stayed in D.C.
So you're only 19.
Only 19. 19. No. 19 to 20. I don't know if but late 19, 20 years old, on the border. So I got married when I was 19. That's before I left Walter Reed.
Yeah.
And 20 is when they discharged me. And I got the medical disability. They told me that I had 5 to 7 years. I'd be lucky if I lived 5 to 7 years after that.
So you were, you say, running the streets.
Running the streets, mad, angry, getting with the wrong crowd. I didn't care about my life, even my own life.
Yeah.
You know, but I was.
And you were married too.
Yes. The only thing that saved me was my music.
Yeah.
Me being involved, me being an artist, me performing, things like that. That was the only thing that really kept my sanity. If I didn't have music, I don't know what would have happened.
Yeah.
You know, I probably would have offed myself, you know, but literally I was trying to do that. you know, through and running the streets and things like that, getting involved in wrong situations, you know, I was just living recklessly. But this is the thing. My philosophy on life, just real quick, is that everybody's born a clear glass of water. And this is why I live here in North Brad. I choose to live here. I don't have to live in this neighborhood or neighborhoods like this. Past 09, that's when I had got my HUD vast voucher. I basically come over anywhere I want to.
Yeah.
But kids are born a clear glass of water. When kids go through similar things or similar dramas, that's like a fountain pen with ink in that water. So when my mom got shot, a squeeze of ink in the water, nobody filtered that out. I never got therapy. Neither did my sister. Or we never talked to nobody about what happened.
So you mean like trauma?
Yeah, trauma. Like it's called technically ACEs, adverse childhood experiences.
Right.
So I had many of those.
Yeah.
Growing up. But so every one of those is like a squirt of ink in that glass. What happens when that glass gets pitch black?
Yeah.
You know, if nobody, this is why I do the ministries I do, because even in this neighborhood, I see it all day, all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, all these kids, you know, these some of these neighborhoods are like war zones. And these are all the neighborhoods I grew up all my life. Some of these neighborhoods are mostly like war zones. So we got a lot of damaged people walking around here with PTSD and ACEs and stuff like that. And if nobody, you know, interjects to filter that water back to clear again, you got hurt people hurting people now.
So you choose to live in Braddock because you this is where you can help people.
Yes, yeah, this is where I work with kids. I'm a street minister, but I don't do no titles. I just call me a man of God. I'm out in the streets, but this is where in my lifetime, since probably 09, I probably mentored over 100 kids.
Yeah.
You know, though it took, but these are kids that I'm able to identify the same traits I had, you know. So most of the kids I go after to help are damaged kids, you know. And I use music to do it, teach them how to rap, write songs, poetry, whatever. Kids love that stuff. So that gives me a window to try to reach them and inject some kind of love in their life to combat that ink that's in that water. Yes. Right. The reason I brought up these topics is because when they gave me a 5 to 7 year life sentence, I'm 46. That's a miracle in itself right there. What happened to my mother is a miracle. For me to even be alive and survive me dealing with mental illness as a result of all these dramas is a miracle. Like I was working for the VA and in 09, like beginning of 09, I would just have these bouts where I would just be crying.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sad. I wasn't even upset. But my soul was literally, I'd be at my job crying like a baby and did not know why.
Yeah.
You know, so I took off from my job to find out what is going on. And that's when I found out that I had PTSD. I was suffering from ACEs. And I had
ACEs
bipolar.
What is that?
ACEs is adverse childhood experiences.
Okay.
So that's like a combination of all the drama I experienced from like birth to like 12 or 14 years old. For adults, they call it PTSD. When it goes, you go past the age of adults, you know, that's PTSD. But I had a whole life.
So ACEs is like PTSD for children.
For kids, yes. Okay. For you, for young kids, young teenagers. Right, yes, yes, exactly. And so the combination of that, all that ink, all that drama in my life, you know, mentally, my mind just couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
You know, amongst other things, I had a lot of gifts. So, like, really, I had a problem with even shutting my mind off. I could never shut my mind off. So I would stay up thinking of all these ideas, writing all this creativity. And the problem was with this, too, is that nobody didn't know the difference from mania or my gifts.
Right.
Because I'm an artist. So they thought I was just being creative.
Right.
What creatives do. But I'd be up for a week at a time sometimes. I hardly slept. Maybe 2 hours at a time. You know, so I finally got into a mental health facility. And, you know, but what happened during that time, I became a promoter. So I used to throw shows. So I turned it. I was a rap artist. I had a record label. So I came.
So this is after you got out of the Army. You're in D.C.
Yes. No, no. I'm in D.C. Then I moved I moved to Pittsburgh in 99. So when I was in Pittsburgh in 99, I was actually came here to join Job Corps, heavy equipment program, and I applied for the job at the VA, and that's how I got into the VA.
Okay.
But this is 09, where I'm working for the VA probably 6-7 years at that time. I'm doing shows, but what happened, at the same time I took off to see what was going on with me mentally, I was doing this show right here.
Yeah.
And what happened, it was a setup where it was for like a big drug dealer they was extorting promoters in the city of Pittsburgh.
Oh.
So I was doing a show, and then all of a sudden the drug dealer came in and was like, "Oh, yo, I'm taking all the money and this and that. You ain't getting none. You do anything, I'll kill your family, kill your kids."
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so this is what happened. So this is the same time the perfect storm happened. So at that time, I was being treated at WPIC, UPMC.
Yeah.
They thought I was a depressive. I was severe depression.
Yeah.
But they didn't know I was bipolar. But what the medicine they gave me shot me into mania, a high state of mania. And this is common with people who they misdiagnosed with depression that are bipolar. They give
them were you an inpatient or outpatient?
I was inpatient for a while, but then I became an outpatient.
So after 2000 and, well, I'm sorry.
This is 2007.
2007.
At this time, yes.
You were committed to WPIC for a little bit.
Well, 2008 I was committed to WPIC on Western Psych for severe depression, but they didn't know I was bipolar.
Okay.
And they gave me this medicine, and the medicine they gave me for depression,
because this is when you were crying
at my job, and I put in for a leave of absence to a medical leave of absence to find out what was going on. So, you know, if you career conditional in the VA, they'll allow you to take a leave. If something is like you got substance abuse or whatever, they'll allow you to take time off to go to rehab and stuff like that. So this was like that kind of situation.
I gotcha.
So while I'm in there, they give me this medicine, and that medicine shoots me into mania. But this is smack dab in the middle of the time I'm shooting this show.
So you're still working and promoting.
Music while I'm off. And I'm going to therapy and stuff, and taking it serious to find out what's going on. But so happened, I got with
these. Life goes on, you know? Yes,
exactly. But so happened, I got involved with these promoters who worked, they was running a scam for this drug dealer. I didn't find out until like a year and a half after the incident that happened. So what happened, when he threatened my wife or my family, subconsciously, I must have never forgot that, because I didn't remember what happened. I had to do a year in Allegheny Prison. So me and him went to war. I must have found out where he, but I don't remember none of this because it was like a fog, a thick fog. So they gave me the medicine. I started going into mania, and that meeting happened. And when that meeting happened.
So you got medicated, and then you were out of the hospital.
I was out, but I was still an outpatient.
You were an outpatient.
Being seen. But the medication they gave me shot me into mania.
And they let you, you know, they weren't watching, keeping up watch on you.
Well, I kind of just disappeared from therapy at that time.
Yeah.
I was in mania. Okay. So I'd like, and then at that time, my child's mother was like, I wasn't asleep, and I was drinking like energy drinks, like back to back, like 10 a day and stuff. And this meeting happened where he threatened my wife and my kids. So what happened, I went and got every single weapon I had, because I'm ex-military, I had guns, I love guns or whatever at that time. And I must have found it, because I don't remember what happened. I didn't piece it together to afterwards when I was in prison. This is like a year, 6 months later, when I'm going to trial for this incident is when I pieced it together, because I was in jail with somebody who knew the person.
So you were so heightened you didn't even remember. You couldn't remember what happened.
This is the only reason they didn't lock me up for 10 years. That's the only reason, because I went in there and told them what exactly happened.
Yeah.
And people from UPMC, WPIC program, came to my hearing and told them what happened about the medication.
Right,
and stuff.
Right.
So what happened is, you know, I must have found out where he stashed his drug. He was a very big drug dealer. He wasn't like no regular drug dealer.
Yeah.
He had security, had guys with guns with him all the time.
Yeah.
So he was never alone. He was always with like 3 or 4 bodyguards with him at all times. And they all had weapons on them and guns. So in my mind, subconsciously, I must have took that threat seriously.
Yeah.
You know, some things are worth dying for, worth going to prison for. I was ready to walk away from the show. I would have left everything. The money, I didn't care about money.
Yeah.
I would have just left that. But when he threatened my wife and my kids, my newborn daughters, I took that serious, because this wasn't no regular threat. This person could actually carry this threat out. You know, he was known for murdering people.
Yeah.
You know, so I took that serious. So I went to this place where he stashed the drugs at or whatever, and I probably shot into that place about 100 and something times. I stood right there.
Wow.
And they was in there bagging up dope and bagging up the coke and everything.
Wow.
So I didn't aim at them to hit them, but I wanted them to know that if he touched, I gave him a message through the show was that night.
So they were not hurt?
No, I didn't. I didn't shoot at
you
them.
You didn't shoot at
yeah,
them.
Yeah, but I shot at their
you
place.
Just shot up their whole, outside
their
of
whole
their
front. The front. They,
but none of the bullets hit
was,
them.
No, it was a barbershop where yeah. they was just. But it was in the basement. I already knew it was in the basement because the guy okay. who I got the information told me everything.
So you shot into the first floor.
Yes, yes.
And there was nobody in there.
Yeah, no. They was in the basement doing the drugs and everything. So I just shot that up. And I stood right there. And the main point I wanted to make, let him know, you know, and this is not me thinking. It's subconsciously. I didn't piece this till later. So I must have been trying to just give him a warning to let him know that if he touched my family or my kids. And my cousin told me that's the message I told him to tell him.
Yeah.
This that happened the night of that show.
So that's the show
day.
Went on.
That night.
The show went on.
That night. The show happened. That's when I shot the place up. That night.
Oh, man.
That night.
Did
so
you
the
make
night
the,
of the
show?
Huh?
Did you see the show?
No. I shot it up. That night it happened. And I was in jail that night.
Oh.
So that when the cops arrived, after I finished shooting, I laid all my guns down, got on my knees. I waited for the cops to come.
Oh, man.
So that lets me know that that was my main intent, or subconsciously.
And you,
I didn't
you
care
don't even
about
remember
escaping.
Doing this. You just know.
No, no. When I came to court, the guy who actually ran the barbershop, I never seen him before in my life. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I knew who he worked for. I knew that was a front for this drug dealer. That's where they shuffled their thing, cooked their product or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it was a whole building, but they just ran the barbershop at the back. Nobody lived in the building.
Yeah.
It was just a front, you know, for them to do drugs at. So when I went to court and went to trial, it was like a haze. I went through it, but like later on, like 6 months later, when I was actually in jail, and because they wouldn't release me because it was like a psychiatric thing. I had to get psychiatric evaluations and everything like that. And by Whippet coming to the hospital, I mean coming to the court hearing, the judge sentenced me to a year of mental therapy because that's what happened, you know.
Yeah.
And I had witnesses who came and said, yes, that medication will cause extreme mania. You know, so he probably was out of his mind when this happened.
Right.
He's not making this up.
Right,
you
right.
know? But my instinct to protect my family or go after him, because that night he gave me the money. That was my bail money from the show.
Yeah.
He told my cousin, tell me he don't want no problems. Because I knew where he lived at. I knew where his mother lived. I knew where everybody. I grabbed one of the guys in that picture, that main person who was performing that night. That's who gave me all the information. I made him tell me everything. The people who introduced me to him, I made them tell me everything about him.
Yeah.
You know, so he didn't want no more problems. And really, I didn't want to handle it like that, but it was just, like I said, I was in a fog. I was in mania. So my instinct kicked in. It wasn't, I was just going on like
autopilot. So you shooting up the place, you didn't lose the money off the show?
No, he gave me my half of the
show.
You
got the money.
The profit, yes.
Your family was
that
safe.
That was my bail money. My cousin delivered
you know,
it to me.
I mean, you were kind of justified, and
yes.
it kind of worked out, right?
And that's what I went there. I know, and plus, I didn't run from the scene. I stood
and you didn't
right
hurt
there.
Anybody.
I didn't hurt nobody. So. That wasn't my goal, to hurt anybody. I just wanted to do damage and let him know that if he did anything, that I would take it farther than that.
Yeah.
This is to let you know that I'm not going to play with you, that I will do anything I say I'm going to do, and I'm serious about it. So if you touch my family or my wife, it's going to go a lot farther than this.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So even though that wouldn't be ideal, what I want to do.
Right.
But that's just the truth of what happened, the situation. I was in mania. My instinct kicked in.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So there we go. And I already done fought many wars on the streets. You know, so I had one time where a group tried to assassinate me.
Yeah.
You know, literally killed me and shot me point blank at me point blank while I was in the car 9 times and it didn't hit me. That's called divine intervention.
Yeah.
So I got many stories like that. But so that's what happened. You know, they sentenced me to a whole year of mental therapy. So not only has I experienced all this PTSD, all this ACEs, I had a drug addiction because I was self-medicating. I had to drink myself to fall asleep. So I would drink a half a liter of Hennessy or something or a whole liter just to sleep. That's the only way I could go to sleep because I was so high on mania.
Yeah.
So I had an alcohol addiction, a drug addiction. And when I went into this course, you know, that's the first time in my life I had time to breathe or think about all that has happened to me up to that point.
Right.
I was like 35, I think, at that time. You know, and this is a miracle too, because I could have been killed. I could have died many a times not knowing what was going on in my mind. So when I found out that I had bipolar, or they did a history of timeline of illness, and that history went all the way back. All these events happened and started when I was 11.
Yeah.
So every year, multiple, I mean, I don't experience hundreds of things. in my life. So, you know, in that form of way, that's a miracle too, that I had, that that judge, you know, sentenced me to a year of therapy. But I was only going to be seen once a month, like a group meeting and see a psychiatrist. But I took it on myself to go to therapy. Like,
like when so I got that year, that year of therapy is when you started to figure everything out.
Everything out. And when I first, when I had any kind of peace in my life, I never had peace since 11. But that was the first time I actually had peace, because everything had to stop. I was allowed to exist in that halfway house, take therapy, and not have to worry about anything else. For the first time, I was able to focus on me, on what happened to me, how to fix it, how to repair myself. You know, so I took full advantage. So instead of me having just the 4 hours a month of therapy, I went to like 30 hours a month. That's what all this behind me. Every course, every NA meeting in that book.
So your book, what's it covering? Just your life story, or what is it?
All the drama I've been to, all the experiences. I've been homeless 3 times.
Yeah.
After I had that motorcycle accident, I told you I lost everything. The Holy Spirit spoke to me again about my daughter. It said my daughter was in trouble. So during that time, my dad had a stroke. So I was going to leave the first time, but my father had a stroke. So I stayed till he got home from the hospital. And then after that, the Spirit spoke to me and said, get back to Pittsburgh. Your daughter needs you. She's in dire trouble. And which I had the evidence of the dire trouble right there in that, on that book, too.
So when is this part happening?
The accident was 2012. This took me 3 years to recover fully from the accident.
So this, the plus accident is your
the motorcycle
accident. Okay.
Yes.
Your experience is like so many things. It's very just bad, amazing how many things have happened to you and you survived all of this. Let's go back to the stroke that happened that we started
with. And I'll pick it right up.
You said that your faith made it so that you were not worried. Mm-hmm. You were not as panicking. You knew you were going to make it through the stroke. So let's go back to the stroke story.
Yes. I'm ready. See, I'm used to this. Most people I meet are not. They're not used to this. You know, because I just gave you a glimpse of why I had that faith.
Yeah, because you have that faith, because your experience in your life is so many things have happened. So much trauma.
Yes.
So many things that God has brought you through.
Yes.
Homelessness, this stroke.
Drug addict.
Not even being able to walk. You just take it in stride. I mean, which is amazing.
And that's what God, that's the reason I think I had to, not think, that's the reason I know I had to experience all of this to be what God has me to be.
Yeah.
You know, I can't do the vision. God gave me 3 visions in 2010. One was that book, the vision about hell. One was the theory of balance, and one was the body of believers. For what I seen in that vision and what God has shown me in them 3 visions, I have to go through all this, because there's no way I can do what God has shown me to do without being this person, without going through this. And that's only not for me. That's, I only have visions. God gave me them visions for the people of God, not for me. Yeah. I'm nobody special. I'm just a part in the body of believers living out my function.
Yeah.
So when I go back to the stroke and I speak about the stroke, I took you back to just those few instances.
just a couple. You know, just a couple. Surface.
So this is why my faith is so strong. Why? Because I've seen miracles. I experienced things and I lived through it. And not just me. Other people miracles. Yeah. Like Micah's.
Right.
I've seen hundreds of other miracles that's not even in my life.
Right.
You know, so that's why I had that faith when I had that stroke. And when I had that stroke, you know, the people around me was more concerned and more scared for me than I was.
Yeah.
I already knew what God was going to bring me through. And when I first had that stroke, I couldn't use the bathroom. I could not literally get out the bed.
So the last thing I heard about your stroke was that your diagnosis, it hit your brainstem. They said you have...
Yes.
Your what was your prognosis? Very low,
like 5%, maybe I'll get 100% of my mobility back. Their diagnosis was that I'm not going to be who I was before this stroke.
Yeah.
Life is going to be completely different.
And now you seem like right now I'm looking at you. I mean, you're still not 100%. Mm-hmm.
But I could walk around. I walk 10 blocks. You know, and when I was in that bed. Yes.
You can hear, you can talk.
And I still have my mental facilities.
Yeah.
I'm still able, like a stroke affects everybody different. And some people have a stroke, they're never the same mentally. You know.
So how was the progression of your healing?
Very slow. Mm-hmm. But this is the reason why I had to go to the VA. So after they ran on them tests, intensive therapy. That's the certificate right there in the middle. That's my graduation from intensive. Now, they came in there. These were extraordinary human beings. I mean, I can't even speak to you about how grateful I am that I was in the VA, because I had some awesome, incredible therapists. I mean, incredible. When they came in, her name was Lauren. She was about your height, a little, about the same weight could be. But she came in there and she was like, all right, let's go. And I was like, what you mean, let's go? I can't move. She was like, no, we're going to get started right now. It was three of them came in there every day. Intensive therapy is 3 hours a day, 6 days a week. They break it up an hour and a half in the morning, an hour and a half in the evening. I was in that program for 2.5 months. They never missed one day of therapy.
Wow.
Never. 6 days a week. So Lauren came in there. And she was like, move your finger. And I was like, what do you mean move my fingers? I just listened to them. Whatever data experts,
yeah,
I'm listening to whatever they told me. So she was like, mentally, well, how she explained it is that your brain can form new neural pathways around the spot where you had the stroke.
Okay.
She's like, so you really got to focus and use your mental ability to visualize every part of your body moving.
Yeah.
So we're going to start with the pinky. So for hours, I would sit there and just think about my pinky moving. And then it would put like electrodes. I got it in that case right there to my skin. It would shock me. Like, you know how you do a frog in science class in high school?
Yeah.
They would do that. And it would start to move my hand. And so as they do that, I would think on it. And so it started out with one pinky, this pinky, moving. Yeah. That was what I could do at first. And then like every day after that, it was... The thing about having a stroke was a blessing. I have a new appreciation for everything in life, mentally, physically, spiritually, and emotionally. You know, I'm way more grateful because having a stroke and coming back the way I did, you know, it's just like one little pinky move. Then it's this thumb, this hand might move, my index finger, so any other finger might move.
You saw slow progression.
Very slow.
But they were working for you with you.
Yes, yes.
For 3 hours a day.
Every day, 6 days a week.
And just to get your hand to move?
Just to get my hand to move. That's all they
had
to
do. That was the first thing you worked on?
Yes, they focused on like one part of the body at a time. Every day, any progression, you know, one part. I had a brace on my whole leg. I had a brace on my arm, you know, basically. And it was like very slow, a very slow process. But it was a powerful process because I had fear since I was 20 years old about my physical being. Mm-hmm. About the physical part of me, not the mental or the spiritual. I was good in that, or the emotion. I was building that since after the prison and God gave me the vision. I was building that, but I still had doubt physically because of the lupus, because of that diagnosis. Yeah. You're going to die in 5 to 7 years and my organs being damaged. But when they came in there and had that go-getter attitude, it felt like I was back in basic training or back in the military again.
Yeah.
Like they was like, we don't care about what the odds are. We're going to get this. We're going to do this. And that awoke the warrior in me physically. That awoke me feeling that energy I felt when I was an athlete in high school. When I go on a wrestling mat, I'm a witness. Yeah. That awoke that part of me physically. Right. You know, and that was why I had to go to the VA.
Yeah.
Because a lot of them was ex-military who was giving me treatment. And also people of God.
Right.
So... when I was in there, I was meeting pastors, chaplains. These are people who are giving me my care. So we have an hour-long discussion, 2-hour-long discussions about God, about the Bible, about miracles. So the whole, it's like God sent a spiritual blanket of all his people around me that was in the body of believers to help me through this experience. So it wasn't adversity. It was actually a learning experience, me getting stronger, me building up. Experience, you know. So it wasn't like, oh, I got a stroke, woe is me. No, it's not. It's just another challenge in life. I'm gonna overcome this. I'm gonna be a better version of myself, like everything else I survive. I'm gonna become a better version, a stronger version of myself because of this, and I'm gonna be able to do God's work and let God use me even more and help more people. That's what I operate off of.
So you already knew that God gives you or all of us challenges.
All of us, yes.
And they're not always a curse. They're a blessing.
No. And not only that, some of the challenges, you know, people give Lucifer or evil a lot more credit than he deserved because we have to be accountable for our choices sometimes, too. Because even though I know I got lupus, and that's mainly the reason I had the stroke, probably, most likely. But I also was 295. I was too heavy.
Yeah.
I weighed too much. I was eating too many Twinkies and cookies and snacks and all that. And I've been warned through the years that, Alex, you got all these other health issues. This weight is not going to help.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to make it worse. And that's really, you know, I had a stroke, you know, part because of the, I'm too heavy.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not healthy at all. But it wasn't the main reason, but still it's part of it. And I could have did something about that. So that made me look at, and my wife, thank God for my wife, because my wife is going to school. She's a chef.
Yeah.
So she changed, but before the stroke, she was just in the learning part. She wasn't, because of COVID, they didn't open up her labs.
Yeah.
So when the stroke happened, they actually, the time they opened up her labs, and she changed the whole dynamic of how we eat in this house because of her love for me, because of what happened, and I needed this. So she like changed everything about our eating. I lost almost 45 pounds since I had my stroke. Yeah. And it's not just because of exercise, it's because of the diet.
Yeah.
Mainly is why I'm losing this weight. Like, this is my breakfast, a shake that has everything the human body needs. Protein, vitamins. She knows all that stuff to a T. So we could talk to her about that when you film her testimony and all that. But that's just a part of, you know, love. The love, living out the definition of love beyond any religious thing or any concept, that's the most powerful thing of all of this. Is living out that definition of love, mm-hmm. loving your fellow man like we love ourselves. And that was an example of what happened when I had my stroke. All these doctors came, all these people was helping me. Lauren pushed me because of her love for me. She wanted to see me excel for her love of veterans. She loved her patients. She loved her job. These ain't no ordinary people just going through the motions doing a job. This is like people like myself who are very passionate about what they do. This is their purpose in life.
Yeah.
They're living out their purpose. So these therapists was a collection of people like that. I got one of my therapists who's going to be writing the forward to my book, who was ex-Special Forces.
Yeah.
Who I had many conversations with, you know, what's his name? Josh. Deacon. He's a deacon. But he, you know, he knew about the theory of balance and knew it inside out, almost like he was part of my book, you know.
Yeah.
But God is sending me these people. And I could see it in his design. I could see the reason I had to go through this.
Yeah.
You know, I had to go through this specific trial. So
this stroke gave you the opportunity to be, you know, kind of like to take a crash course or an experience with all these people that you're talking about.
Yes.
These therapists. And
yes.
I mean, you were like immersed.
Yes. That are helping me now. Like, you know, like as long as I'm in their care, VA policy, they can't really do nothing with me or be friends with me. But if I'm out of their care, they can.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm out of their care, they can't. So a lot of them, these are friends I'm gaining for life, basically.
Yeah. So when you have the stroke, it damages your brainstem and your nerves. And so it blocks.
Yes.
So those nerves are dead.
Dead.
The ones that are going to the left side of your body.
Yes.
And so when you're in physical therapy, they're trying to make different pathways.
Yes. With my the neurologic is trying to form different pathways around. Was the thing of like a big burn spot. That's what, what a stroke looks like on wherever you had a stroke at. So they got my neurons to fire, go around the burn spot and reconnect again. And which is very believable because when I had my motorcycle accident, I had a lot of internal bleeding. And actually, I had to have 3 surgeries because my body, they had to check to make sure it wasn't tumors, but I had 3 operations. My body actually cocooned the blood that was inside of me.
Oh.
Like the blood that was flowing that shouldn't been there. Because after a while, it turns poisonous to the body.
Yeah.
So my body actually formed masses around the blood to trap it.
Oh, gosh.
So the human body is amazing. Yeah. It's an incredible thing that what it can do and how it can heal itself.
Yeah.
You know, and doing a VA, thank God they just started doing a whole bunch of new therapy like Chinese medicine. So I don't just do PT and occupational therapy. I do yoga therapy, Tai Chi therapy.
Yeah.
I'm doing acupuncture.
Yeah.
Like, I have a very open mind to anything. So I'm always trying to find new ways or better ways to improve myself. So I tried everything. And then with the theory of balance, the time management part, I actually switched everything and put the physical my number one priority.
Yeah.
So most of my time in that scheme of that time balance, I put for the first time in my life, because of this stroke. If I never had this stroke, I would have never had put my physical first.
Yeah.
What would have never happened?
Right.
But because of it, you know, God's plan for me, you know, I think people are like a ball of clay. And through the scriptures, adversity and trials and tribulations is the number one way God molds and shapes people.
Yeah.
To a perfect statue, a beautiful statue. But through them trials, he's carving it out and shaping what you were supposed to be.
Yeah.
You know, but without adversity, how would you have that?
Right.
You know, you don't have to go through what I went through, but everybody experiences adversity some way, mentally, physically, spiritually. That's why I never compare adversity, because what's a mountain to me might be a molehill to somebody else. This stroke might be big to somebody.
So the miracle is kind of like a two-sided miracle. The one side that you might think of at first is, okay, I had a stroke and I survived. I didn't die, and my body's coming back when it probably shouldn't have. You know, some people have a stroke, they never can walk again, but you can walk again.
Yes, the whole ward I was in, they had people, veterans, who was there for like 3-4 years because they couldn't go home.
Yeah.
Because they had to just keep them there because they couldn't function after their stroke.
They're just going to be in a nursing home the rest of their life
because
but
of your the stroke.
You're home, you can walk. And you're continuing to get better.
Stronger every day, every week. You know, I mean, even the doctors who first had me, they are actually following me, keeping track of me, because they said they never seen nobody come back this fast from the kind of stroke I had.
So you may get to 100% again.
Oh, yes. I had no doubt I will.
And you will.
I had no doubt I will.
That's the one side of the miracle.
Yes.
The other side of the miracle is that God gave you this adversity,
yes,
as a blessing.
To
help you, to strengthen you, to mold you.
Yes,
you know,
and that's the main thing with adversity. People, I try to. And that's why I'm writing this book. One of the reasons, and I tell people about it when I'm on the street or I testify to them and tell them that, you know, no matter what you're going through in life, I mean, I don't care if you're down, you're homeless, you know, I've probably been there with you or been through it, you know, or whatever you're going through in life, it's your perspective of how you look at this, you know, because anything that you make, some people make mistakes or whatever, but a mistake really is not a mistake if you adapt to it and learn from it. Only when you repeat errors in your life, then that's a pattern, that's a mistake then. But if you can learn from it and overcome that, that's a great thing, because you are still alive. You have life. So you have hope. You can become a better version of yourself. And through all these adversities, looking back, I could see why I had to go through each specific one.
Yeah.
I deal with kids. How can I go out in these streets of North Braddock, Homewood, Wilkinsburg, and deal with all this, these kids who are dealing with these horrible situations if I didn't go through it? They will pick up in a second. If I didn't have that experience, this guy don't know what he's talking about. But because I've been through it, and because of love, I'm able to reach them and any adults or anybody, you know. But going back to the stroke, that's why I went through all these other things, because they built up. They're connected. Nothing is not connected. I wouldn't be who I am today, or wouldn't have been the person to be able to persevere that stroke. And that's why I showed the stroke. It's not something I overcame. It's something I'm going through
right
now. I'm in the midst of this battle fighting to get back 100%.
Yeah.
And I picked this as an example because even if you're in a homeless shelter, even if you're in a drug program, even if you're prostituting, you're stealing, you're selling drugs, or you got cancer or some kind of disability, you still have hope. There's still hope for you, and you can still become a productive part of society. I don't care if you got mental illness, bipolar, schizophrenia, whatever it is, there is nothing too big that God cannot overcome, that the human spirit cannot overcome.
Right. You know? That's and you've seen it all. It's hard. You know, it's hard. You're seeing. You're here. You're seeing it. You lived it. Some people's problems are nothing compared, and they're complaining about their problems, you know, and you've seen you know what you list are huge problems, and that can be overcome.
See, the thing with this is, I have a friend named Sean Francis. He runs a company called Perspective. He's a psychologist, all kind of stuff. But a person's perspective plays a big role in it. It says in the scripture, it rains on the just and the unjust alike. So if you have life and you're born into this world, you're going to face adversity.
Yeah.
There's no way around it. So instead of fearing adversity, knowing that it's going to be part of our life, You should embrace adversity as a building tool. It builds you.
Yeah.
You know, people don't have to experience, like in Wall Street when they had the stock market crash. In my mind, I would never jump off a building and kill myself for money.
Yeah.
But to this person, losing that money was everything to them.
Yeah.
You know, their perspective on the money was completely different to mine. Yeah. They might have never lived without money. They might have been born with this money. They might have had millions and millions of dollars. And to them, that was the end of the world to them.
And that's hard to see adversity as a blessing. It's hard to see. Because you always say, you see adversity, you think, oh, that's the devil. And you're saying,
yes,
it's not the devil. It's not God. All the time.
Yeah. It's God. It's both. It can be. Satan can send adversity to you. God can also send adversity to you. But you can send yourself through your own adversity because of your choices.
Yeah.
See, humans don't like to really be fully accountable to themselves.
Yeah.
Just like I had that stroke. Yeah, part of the stroke is my lupus. It's me being physically sick for years. But I'm also 295 pounds. Yeah. How is that helping? So do I take accountability for that part of what I did? Or I'm going to say, woe is me and blame everybody else, but not look at the man in the mirror.
Yeah.
The man in the mirror is the first person we should look at whenever we come to any adversity, because we got to figure out what's our role in that adversity.
Yeah.
Did we cause it, or things that we did led to it? Of course, I had a horrible background, all these ACEs and PTSD, but in that, some choices I made that wasn't right. You know, and when I got locked up, I had to take accountability for that.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to change. Let me change my behavior. Let me change how I conduct myself. If I want different results, I gotta look into me and identify what am I doing wrong, and then use all the sources of assets I can to help improve myself. You know.
Yeah. So what I wanted to ask you too about was when we talked about doing your interview, you said I want to do this right now because I'm in the middle
of it
of a miracle.
Yes.
How do you keep your faith? How do you keep your hope going? Because I mean, there's got to be days where you you depressed.
Yes.
Are you angry? Yes. Are you
not angry? But it's some rough days.
You know, is it rough? Yeah, because one day you can walk, and 10 months later, like you're just 100%. Ten months later, you're still having problems. I mean, how do you get through those dark days? Mm. How do you keep your faith going?
Love. I have a lot of friends, you know, and I learned. Because sometimes I could be like a little antisocial. Surprisingly, that would be probably the last thing you would think. But sometimes, you know, I had to use my friends, use their love, use their strength, my family, my loving wife, my kids. You know, it's how I look at the situation. And, you know, I'm basically, like I said, I'm striving to live out the definition of love. So that's to become love.
Yeah.
You know, and that's using all these resources. I have all God has sent me. I might have had a very hard life, but I had a very loving and beautiful life also at the exact same time. So, you know, I prayed for my wife. I went to a year praying for my wife, and God sent me a wife made perfectly just for me. She's not perfect. I'm not perfect, but we are perfect for each other. That's a big part of this, because my wife was there. When I couldn't wipe myself, I couldn't wash myself.
Yeah.
I couldn't, you know, who did that? Without complaining, she just hopped right in. Yeah. I mean, I can't even destroy. I don't think I could even, I don't know how I would even have done it without her. I would have had to been an inpatient in the hospital.
Yeah.
I mean, it could have happened, but I would have been an inpatient. I wouldn't have been able to come home.
Right.
To probably right now.
Yeah.
I would have been coming home right now because I would have had to get to this level to take care of myself. Now I'm able to wash up and do things for myself. And I just meditate on the word of God. I meditate on love. And I want to clarify this. I don't just read the Holy Bible or the Quran or the Torah. I learn from everything.
Yeah.
The entire planet. Because before any book was made, before any language, before any religion, God created the world. And he created all that's in the world. And he created us in the image of God. So I think that you got to have an open mind and learn from everything. Like my mom raised me in the church. I was thankful for that. But I wanted to find out who God was for myself.
Yeah.
That's why I read all these different Bibles, all these books on religion. I was seeking to find out who that was. And through that personal relationship, you know, that's what I think is a big part of what got me through that spirit, the spiritual connection that I have with God.
Yeah.
Hearing the Holy Spirit speak to me, being having that personal relationship, you know, staying in prayer, you know, I don't have to be on my knees, but my thoughts are on. No, I'm not perfect, but my thoughts, I try to improve myself every single day.
So you're praying. You're praying
constantly. But basically, prayer is nothing but your thought meditating on it. If you're thinking about God and you in that zone of doing love, because I have a lot of friends like these conversations right here, me and you have. I have this every day, all day. Yeah. I'm in church, literally. Because when two or more people speak about God, God is in the presence. That's church.
Yeah.
It's not the physical building, but I'm always in church. I'm always talking about love. And this is a gradual process. I wasn't born like this. Yeah. I wasn't like this when I was 20. I wasn't like this when I was 25. But it's a gradual building process. That's why I never judge other people, because I don't know. You know, I don't need to know, but my beliefs don't require nobody else to believe them. I'm going to love you regardless. I got friends who are atheists.
Yeah.
I'm going to love you regardless. I don't care about no religion, you Buddhist, Baptist, whatever. All I care about is love. Can I love you? That's my most powerful ministry. When I'm on the streets, I don't carry my Bible. I don't carry none of that. But all I do carry is love. That's why I get such a response back. And that's what the body of believers is about. All of us. Since 2009, I've been joining any church, any temple. I go there, I join it. Yeah. They'd be like, oh, this ain't your home church or this and that. Well, any house of God is my home. Why I got to join just your church? So you mean tell me God is only in your church at this Rodman Baptist church? Or God is only in this Catholic church? Or God is only in this Muslim temple? No. We got to unify. And that's the whole point of the body of believers, too. But to unify in love, the human race needs this now more than ever. We got to unite.
Yeah.
North Braddock, all this crime, there's like 30 churches here. None of them work together. Why not? Yeah. If you're all people of God.
Right. Yeah.
To solve these problems.
That's true.
Your church is in the middle of these war zones. Why y'all not working together to help these kids who are being killed every day? Why don't I never see you when I'm on the street? Talking to these people. Where are you, men of God? Where are you?
Yeah, that's true. So you're surrounded, you know, your wife.
Yes.
Sometimes you lean on your family, your
friends. Yeah, my son, too.
When you're not feeling, feeling good.
My little son walks with me. Every time I go a walk, my walker right there, he walks with me.
Yeah.
Bryson. So, you know, I get him a bag of chips, but we get to share time. Just little things like that. Mm-hmm. But my wife, I get to share time with her. Like, when she used to wash me up, I make jokes and stuff like that. But all these people care about me. It's a lot of love in the world.
Yeah.
But it's just not unified. It's not working together. But
together. The thing that you're a founder of is called Body of Believers
United. The Body of Believers Unified.
And you have a YouTube channel where you're doing interviews. And you can just look up the Body of Believers United.
T-H-E,
And then you could subscribe to,
to your, like, share,
your
comment.
Movement. Mm-hmm. So you want to unify
people of God. All the people of God, yes.
Whether you're Muslim, Buddhist,
Seventh-day Evangelist, Jehovah's Witness, Buddha. I don't care what it is.
Hinduism,
all of it. Yes.
All the religions.
All of it. God's people.
Everybody that believes in God.
Yes.
Should be unified.
Yes, yes. I believe
so. And instead of Muslims and
arguing
Christians
with each other.
Or whatever, Jews fighting and killing each other.
Yes, yes.
They should say we all have the same God.
Yes.
We all have the same needs.
Foundation, the fundamental principles
are
the same.
We should all be loving each other.
Working together in unity.
It seems like a simple.
it seems simple.
Simple, right?
But I can't tell you how many churches I've been put out of for preaching what I'm talking to you about. For literally preaching about love, about unity, about gathering, about like a neighborhood like Homewood that's crime written. Even though Braddock, crime written. How are all your churches not working together to do? I'll tell you, when I'm on the street and I have conversations, some people, they say they never heard nobody speak the way I speak about the church, about people of God. They say the church want to bring me a Bible, Jesus, and prayers, but they give me no way to transform out of this lifestyle into another lifestyle.
Yeah.
So what I see is, why don't all these churches, they take tithes and offering every day they're open. How come they don't, at the end of the year, tie 10% of their gross to a project or 10% of their offerings together to target this neighborhood which they reside in and build a shelter that a building that could train these convicts or people with records who can't get jobs who are selling drugs. Why don't they build a building and train them in construction? Yeah. Train them in to be an electrician. Train them to be a painter or carpenter.
Yeah.
So they can put down their guns. Right. That's the number one thing I hear. They want to give me a Bible, prayers, and Jesus, but they give me no way to get out of this lifestyle. I still got to pay bills. How am I going to pay my bills? I don't want to sell drugs. I don't want to be carrying a gun. I don't want to be getting shot at or chased by cops. But what are you giving me besides Jesus, a Bible, and prayers that could take place in my lifestyle? How I'm going to feed my kids? How I'm going to pay my bills? I got rent too.
Right. And that's what I always wondered about, because I live over in Ingram.
Yes.
And the Catholic church they had down there in Sheridan, which is an area that needs help, they close that church, that Catholic church, and they keep all the Catholic churches open in the wealthy areas where people are given money. So the churches that aren't income.
Yeah, functioning like a corporation.
Now you should think the churches that are most needed should be most open and have the most services. But it's the opposite. So
that's what I thought too. When I went in there bringing this message of love and unity, they don't either they kick me out or they'd be like, "Oh, we'll call you. But don't call us though. We'll call you."
Yeah.
That was a great sermon. You need your own church, brother. You know, because I'm talking about unifying, and they're about. See, I'm not for. I had money. I was on the streets. I had $30,000 at a clip. Made $30,000 at the show. You know, bringing artists like El Cool J and stuff to different shows. I did that, and I was never happy when I had that money because I was taking it for the wrong reasons.
Yeah,
I'm more wealthy now today than I ever been in my life.
Yeah,
than I ever been. You know, and I can still get money, whatever, but I'm not going to be buying no $350,000 car or a mansion or a six-car garage. For what? There's people in here who don't even have vehicles.
Yeah.
Out here suffering. See, love is different. When you understand the definition of love, the whole definition, that's compassion, mercy, forgiveness. How can you sit in those four walls and watch everyone around you suffer, but you don't come out them four walls? Jesus Christ was hardly ever in a church.
Yeah.
So was the disciples. So was the apostles. They was in amongst the community.
Yeah.
So I'm a soldier. They send soldiers to war zones, hot zones. All them churches, they good. I love them. But you're going to safe zones, the hospital. You're going to the prison. You're going where you're not intermingling with people are dying on these streets every day.
Yeah.
Where are you? If you love your community, you love the people of God. Christ said he came for the sinners, not the saved.
Yeah. And that's something that I wonder about too. Is sometimes churches will have a mission to, Haiti, and I'm sure people in Haiti need help too.
They do. Yes.
But there's people
in America,
two
right
blocks
here.
Away from where I live,
right here. Yes.
That need help.
Yes.
And I think the churches do have.
Yes.
They have soup kitchens and,
they all good ministries. They're good ministries.
They do have that stuff, but we should, for me, I'd like to get more involved in helping people in our own area,
And that's what the body of believers is about, because we're a virtual church. So so let me give you a little background. Since 2009, I've been joining every church, every temple. I gathered over 1,000 people. So what I'm doing now, only been open for like 2 weeks now with the Body of Believers YouTube channel. So I'm gathering all these people who have the like mind as I have.
Yeah.
So I had like Muslim mentors, Buddhist mentors, all kind of different religion mentors that I gathered who believe as I believe. So what I had to do, when God gave me that vision, he showed me to circumvent the church, the buildings of the church, the institution.
Right. Just go the person
corporate.
To person.
Go, he told me to go to the churches, but don't seek to preach there or things like that. Seek out the people.
Yeah.
Because churches are the people. The people are the church.
Yeah.
Church is just a building where they gather.
Right.
So if I gather the people who think like I have and have the same philosophy, now I'm gathering the true church.
Yeah.
A church that's really going to be active in the community.
That is a great thing you're doing.
Yes,
I think that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's wonderful.
And not just, you know, I have, like I said, I got friends that are atheists.
Yeah.
They're closer to God than probably than most people are who go to church every day. I'll tell you why. Because they actually are Peter. I call them agents of love.
Right.
Because they're really living out the definition of love. Like, there's stories in the Bible.
Right. Because they were like, yes. What do you call them? Secular humanist?
Yes.
Where
yes.
they don't believe in God per se, but they
yes.
they believe in helping people.
And that is God
and
to me.
That's good as, that's more practical God. Than a lot of people.
It says
things.
God is love, love is God. So if right. they people are love, hello, yeah, they're doing a great job, you know?
That's fine, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I said. My beliefs don't require anybody else to believe them. Who am I to tell you your path to God? Do we got to argue about this when kids are dying? It's a waste of time to me. It's
right.
totally asinine to me. Because people need help out here in this world, in these streets, in all neighborhoods, not just mine. And my hopes is that if I can unite the people in the neighborhood, you know, people will come outside of this neighborhood to help. Because people love helping people who show that they're willing to help themselves. How can we have human unity when we're not even unified in our own community?
Yeah.
If we want people to come, our brothers and sisters from across the lines to come and help us, we must bind together and show that we're trying to do something for ourselves. Nobody likes to help somebody. You got to over and over again, but they never do nothing for themselves.
Yeah.
We got to help ourselves first.
Right.
And then help will come. I believe help will come, you know, like that. Yes.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, I'm glad. I'm, you know, you have so many good stories, and that's one reason why you got to keep writing your book, which I know you're working hard on that.
Yes, yes.
And you said it would be out in
December
this year.
December 27th.
Which it's...
with the same publisher that Micah has.
Yeah, so that I can't wait to read the whole book.
Yes,
because you can go into a lot more detail than we can do on the podcast. And you're so many miracles have happened to you, but this stroke you're going through now and you're... Your faith that you have is amazing. So we'll follow up with you and see how you're doing. We'll check in.
Thank you so much.
And keep in touch with you there. And I encourage people to look at your YouTube channel.
The Body of Believers Unified.
The Body of Believers Unified. And the YouTube channel is the best thing to do right now.
Yes. Okay. That's where we got all the videos at and things like that. And the thing with the stroke is, this is the first time really in my life that I faced adversity where I had no fear.
Yeah.
This is the first time that this happened.
You're building. You're getting...
The whole time, yes.
You're building, and it's amazing, because that's what really couldn't get through my mind, is like, how are you like totally... So freaked
full
out.
Of, yes,
and
yes,
you're
so
like, well, I'm
out.
Just laying in bed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that would be the
days.
Normal response.
It just,
yeah.
It is just like, it's incredible that your faithfulness and how you you heard the Holy Spirit and you were not
been
afraid.
Been obedient, yes.
You know, it's
yes.
like, be not afraid.
Mm-hmm,
and
yes.
God's, Jesus says it's that so you. Many times, do not be afraid. And and you showed that, you know, and later in life, I mean, you were probably scared other times. When you were younger, but you've gotten to this point now where you're not
afraid. I had no fear. Yeah, because when that happened, after I had a motorcycle accident and God spoke to me and said, your daughter's in trouble, come back to Pittsburgh. I had to get back on the same motorcycle. That's the only way I had to get back. And I rode that motorcycle back here from North Carolina, but not knowing where I was going to live.
Yeah.
I was living in the streets for 6 months. Oh. I was living on the north side under the little bridges.
Oh, my God.
I was sleeping until I got into the VA homeless shelter for veterans.
Yeah.
You know, but I was scared totally the whole time. But this time I had no fear. I mean, I listened that time. And when I got here, the spirit was right. My daughter was one incident. I got a 15-page report of my daughter cursing out teachers, fighting in school.
Yeah.
One more incident. She was in Propel school for the gifted students.
Yeah.
One more incident. She was getting kicked out of the school system. So the spirit was right. My daughter was in grave danger.
Yeah.
And I came here in the nick of time, and she started turning around as soon as I got here, as soon as she saw me.
Yeah. Wow.
You know? But this time, there was no fear. The whole time riding that motorcycle back from North Carolina here, I was scared out of my mind.
Yeah.
You know, the fear of just getting back, but I knew if I didn't get back on that bike, I would never, ever ride a bike again. That fear would have crippled me, like what just happened.
Yeah.
The fear from me having lupus and them telling me about my death sentence, 5 to 7 years, that put great doubt in me physically.
Yeah.
So from 20 years old to right now, to the point I had this stroke, I had a handicap physically. Yeah. How can I write a book called The Theory of Balance, How to Improve Your Quality of Life Mentally, Physically, Spiritually, and Emotionally if I'm not living to my full capability physically? How can I do that? Yeah. So God pointed that out to me by giving me this stroke, by me having this stroke. It said, so no longer through this adversity, fight or flight, I decided to fight. I don't care what condition my body is. I decided to now give 100% like I do to my spirituality. Now I fight like I read the books and build my mental. Now I do it physically.
Yeah,
I do most of my PT now. I'm doing so well, I don't have to even go to the hospital no more. I'm really doing everything here in my house myself.
Yeah,
but it's a lifestyle now that I incorporated to be physically in shape, to get better, to eat better. Now it's but because of that stroke is why.
Yeah.
So that had to happen for
it's
me.
So,
to...
It's so weird that you say the stroke is a blessing. You know?
Yes, yes. It's, oh, definitely. It's amazing. Definitely. It's amazing. I love my wife more.
And that's really, yeah. I mean, I, you know, this podcast, it's a way for me to meet people like you.
I love it.
And learn. I'm learning. This is my education.
Yes,
so.
I love it. I love the idea of the podcast. I think it's a beautiful thing. I think it's because the most powerful weapon we have is testimony.
Yeah.
And so by you sharing these stories, it let people know that God is real. God is alive. He's still in the moat. The same power he gave Moses, Matthew, David, Joshua, we have that power. We have access to that power.
These miracles are showing it. These stories are still happening.
He's still healing, still raising people from the dead. Yeah. I mean, doing all kinds of stuff. He rose my mother and Micah from the dead. They was technically dead.
Right. No, it's great to hear. It's so great to hear that, because sometimes you think, Jesus or God doesn't do miracles like he used to.
Yes.
But he does. He keeps doing miracles
every day.
And we got to write them down.
Yes. You know,
we
got to share them.
Some people say, oh, it's blasphemy. You can't write any more books of the Bible. But, you know, we should be writing more books of the Bible, you know?
You're exactly right. That is so true. You're exactly right. What do you think we are living out?
Right.
You know,
right.
Same God from the beginning is here now. And so is his people.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Alex. Oh, this was an honor. This is great. Yes. I'm sorry we can't do it all, but that's a reason.
No problem.
That's
no
a
problem.
Reason for people to read your book. I can't wait to hear it. I can't wait to read the whole thing.
Thank you so much.
All the detail, everything you want to say, not just my interview. I can't wait
to share this and bring.
But this is just be an introduction to your story and some of your miracles. But I want to check back in with you and see how you're doing in the future. And thank you so much.
And I wish you most success, and I'm going to work to bring as much people I can to you with some great testimonies.
I appreciate it.
Yes, yes. Amen. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's been an honor, brother. I appreciate it. Really do.
Okay, I could talk to Alex forever. For more information about Alex's ministry, subscribe to his YouTube channel, The Body of Believers Unified, and look for his upcoming book, The Theory of Balance. If you have a miracle story, call in and leave a message, 412-446-0330, or visit miraclehotline.com. If you truly believe in your heart that you have experienced a miracle, we want to hear from you. If your story is compelling enough, we will play it on the podcast, and we may even interview you. Subscribe to the Miracle Hotline podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any podcast app to automatically download the newest episodes. The Miracle Hotline podcast is sponsored by Imagine Audio and Media for all of your audio and video production, voiceovers, and CD and DVD duplication. Visit imagineaudiomedia.com. This has been the Miracle Hotline podcast. My name is Dino Pandolfo. Please give us a call at 412-446-0330 with your miracle story, or visit miraclehotline.com. Thanks for listening, and please call in